is good. It is good. He has ransomed us. That's a biblical term. He has ransomed us. The price of his own life. I've been saying it all weekend long, but we're close now. It's almost Easter. But first, the glory and the pain and the horror and the shame of the cross. And even before that, the beauty and the heartache that is the longest chapter in the Gospel of Mark. It's chapter 14. It's where we're going today. I want you all now, after a special time of worship here at each of our sites, everywhere, if you would just now, everybody just take a deep breath and just sit down. If you want to say hello to someone, you certainly can. I'm going to let everybody on all of our platforms off the hook. Let me just specifically say hello to those of you joining us in Fenton, Grants Trail, Mid Rivers, the hub here. South America, South Africa, South Europe, I guess all points south. We just want to welcome the South. So we've just got people everywhere, campuses everywhere. So just welcome. Today we're going to continue in this study that we've been in. It's the life and times of Jesus as they are recorded in the Gospel of Mark, which was written altogether by. Well, yes, like not even half of you were confident on that. That's as easy as they get, guys. The Gospel of Mark was written by, there you go. And technically, we would say John Mark. It was written by John Mark. And so this is a guy that shows up in the New Testament in several places. Interestingly enough, so does his mom. His mom's name is Mary. Not that Mary. It's a common name. She owns a house. We see in Acts chapter 12, she owns a house that was sort of the meeting place for the early church. You can see that. There was a room in that house. Now you kind of place, you go back to Acts 1, where there's talk of an upper room that they immediately met in. And then there's an upper room in today's story. And some scholars start to put all of this together and say, well, I wonder if it's all the same upper room. Was this kind of where they all met? Which could mean that the Last Supper took place in John Mark's home. We don't know. At this point, we just don't know all of that. But some of those things start to line up. What we do know is that he's writing this between the mid-50s and the mid-60s AD. He's writing with the help of Peter, the Apostle Peter, and he are in Rome. It's Mark who's writing all of these things down. It's an intense gospel. It's fast-moving, fast-paced, jump cuts, lots of supernatural. It's been a ride, hasn't it? And today, things slow down a little bit as we start to move closer to the cross, but what you're going to see is really a study in contrast. So I want you to pay attention to that today. It's a study, really, of the contrast between greed and gratitude, between selfish and selfless. It's really a story of failures and followers. Now, when you hear that, some of us immediately go, oh, well, I'm neither one of those. I'm not a follower and I'm not a failure. I'm a leader, Greg. My middle name is John Wayne. Well, good. Technically, your middle name is two names. But anyway, I'm just going to say at this point that most of us live in the tension of those two words. You see, what you're going to find out today is that for many people, failing and following, it's wrapped up in the same life. It's our story sometimes. So let's look at this together. Let's see what God says to us. I hope along the way, and it won't be in three-point boom, boom, boom kind of a fashion, but I hope you begin to see why all of this matters, what it looks like when you follow, and what do you do when you fail? Maybe we can learn something today from these characters. But first, let's pray. Father, we come before you now, across all sites, across really the world now. We're humbled by that. But help us, Lord, to hear your voice in a story that we might just look at from afar. Draw us in. Help us to find our place in all of this and speak to us today, whether we're longtime, already convinced believers or still figuring this out. God, some of us are here today and we don't trust any of this. There are people who don't trust you, me, the church. God, all I want them to do is to trust you. So speak to them today. In the name of Jesus, I ask these things. Amen. Okay, let me give you an update from last week. We talked about this thing that was going to happen on Monday where we had leaders that came from around the bi-state area, and we had pastors and worship leaders and staff and entrepreneurs and business leaders and political types and professors, and everybody came together. There were local speakers. There were national speakers that came. It was a thing. This worship band that we had up here was comprised of 8 different churches in this city, and it was a taste of heaven if you were here. It was something. And it was all around the topic of how do we begin to work together, even we who are different in so many ways. And I believe God started something. Very cool. Now, fast forward a little bit later in the week, we're trying to put up some signage, some new signage for Easter here at this campus, signage that we just simply haven't had before. And in the digging of the hole, let's just say, we're not worried about blame, but let's just say a conduit was nicked. Okay, a conduit containing like power, and it didn't knock the power out, but it knocked out the backup power to a generator that we try to have redundancy systems and things like that. And so all of that was being worked on Friday, and as they're putting the juice back in this thing, I don't want to bore you with the technical because I know about it, you're not supposed to laugh. So it did something to the part of our IT infrastructure that basically, you ever heard of the internet? We lost all connectivity, which means we would have lost live stream, which you can imagine the things that are now going on in our head. And this is Friday, people, okay? Now, again, I don't want to overwhelm you with technical terms, but this is a flux capacitor, all right? And a part of it fried, and we weren't really sure what part. But here's the interesting thing. For us to be in business, we had to have this thing. And so we would have ordered it from HP, and we would have gotten it this coming Tuesday, which means we would have been out of business for so much of our ministry here. I'll just keep the story short and say that because of a network of churches and really technical guys that support each other in churches, this was given to us by a local church. Calvary Chapel in St. Charles County said, oh, here, use this. We've got one. That's why we're in business. So if you know anybody from Calvary Church, if you know their pastor, if you drive by there, this is actually living out what we talked about on Monday. I mean, that's it. That's us working together. So thank you. We'll be writing a note to them. You just be careful with this, okay? I know this is a little bit over your head, but this is just be careful with this, okay? Or we'll never get the DeLorean up to 88. So, no, go ahead. Sorry, it's just a joke. Here we go, you ready? Last week, Jesus took his disciples up to the border to a place that was crawling with cooties. We're way up in a dark spot where there was idol worship, where there was a temple built to Caesar Augustus, son of God. Jesus pushes back on all of that. He openly admits, yes, I am Messiah. I am the son of the Most High God. It is a defining moment. There's a lot more that happens. And in the interest of getting us to Easter, we're going to fast forward a little bit. We'll come back to some of these stories later. But Jesus takes the crew south. They're now going to head back south towards Jerusalem. It's probably early fall. I'm going to guess at least September. And what's happening here is they're going to be in town for these religious feasts that occur towards the end of the calendar year. Every time Jesus is in Jerusalem, he's treated poorly. Controversy, conflict, not received well at all. He's received much better in the outlying region. We would call this Judea. And so you'll see now in the final months of his life, this is where Jesus operates. A lot of stuff happens outside of Jerusalem. If he has a base of operation in this time frame, and it doesn't quite compare, but if he has a base of operation like he did up north with Capernaum, it would be in a city called Bethany. Bethany is a couple of miles outside of Jerusalem. So it's just right around the shoulder of the Mount of Olives. There's a home there, the friends of his, Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. This is where they live. You might recognize those names. I will tell you that in this time frame, Jesus is out doing ministry outside of this area, like across the Jordan River, and he gets word that Lazarus is sick. Then he gets word that Lazarus is dead. And then he comes back to Bethany, and he raises Lazarus from the dead. That is supernatural. For some of you who are just joining us, you're like, that's what I struggle with. We've talked openly about this. We quote philosophers, quantum physics. We're looking at all of this. We can't explain it all. What we're telling you is this. there is more to this than all of this. Jesus raises him from the dead. Here's what's different. Anytime he's done a miracle in Mark so far, what is the very next thing that he says? Keep a lid on it. Don't tell anybody. Not this time. He does this in front of the whole village. Everybody sees it. Everybody's talking. Many believe this starts things in motion. In fact, the Sanhedrin, this religious council, now is trying to figure out what to do with him because he's got momentum. In the Gospel of John, this is horrible, just sickening. These religious leaders came to a consensus. This is what we need to do. From that day, they decided they were going to kill him. Unbelievable, but that's what's going on. Jesus avoids Jerusalem for the time being until it's Passover. Now he comes back. He knows he will die. He knows he's coming back to Jerusalem and he will die. He's told his followers this. He's ready for this. The city swells because everybody comes to celebrate many times over. I mean, you're trying to find a place to stay. Jesus knows where he's staying. He's staying in Bethany with his friends. It'll be good to see them. It's been a little while, weeks at least, since Lazarus and the miracle that started everybody talking. The rest of the country is asking this question. Will the prophet, this famous Jesus that we're all wanting to meet, will he show up at the feast? I mean, his enemies have it out for him. Will he be there? Mark sets the table pretty quickly. If you've been studying Mark with us, this shouldn't surprise you. But here it is. He begins to tell us that the religious leaders, trying to figure out how they're going to kill Jesus, are realizing they're going to have to be careful. They don't want to start a riot. So how do we get this done? They don't know. They'll get their answer today. But then this. What we see, if you just continue in Mark chapter 14, while he, this is Jesus, was in Bethany, reclining at the table in the home of Simon the leper. Now, this is obviously someone who has been cured of or healed from leprosy, right? Otherwise, nobody's coming to that dinner party. So Simon the leper, healed maybe by Jesus, likely by Jesus, throws this party. Jesus is reclining at the table. We'll get to that in a second. During dinner, a woman came with an alabaster jar of very expensive perfume made of pure nard. Nard is this oil that is extracted from a plant that grows in India, in the Himalayas. Very expensive, very fragrant, very concentrated, very powerful. She takes this expensive perfume, breaks the jar, so there's that, breaks the jar and poured the perfume on his head. Now, we don't know much more about this story from Mark, but if you've been with us, we'll find other gospel accounts and we'll lay them alongside each other so that we can fill in some of the details. Let me help you with this. This story is told in three of the gospels, Matthew, Mark, and John. There's a story that's kind of similar in Luke, but don't confuse that. Different region, different woman, different background, different story. But in these three gospels, you can see some things. In John, he gives us a lot of the details. First of all, he tells us who did this. It was Mary, as in Mary and Martha, the sisters of Lazarus. It was Mary. She lived in Bethany. She's the one doing this. Now, you got to know that these anointings were not uncommon. These kinds of things happened. Why? Here's the culture. It says that he's reclining. He's eating at this table. Well, by recline, it means you're kind of leaning down probably on one elbow, and you're low to the ground. The food is right there, and you put your feet kind of aimed away from the food. So let's just get the geography right. Food, feet. Feet. Food. In an era where people are walking around, it's hot, it's dusty, you're sweaty, maybe you got a little donkey or camel poop on the sandals. There's some things that have to happen if you're going to have this meal. Common courtesy, those feet would have been washed. And then you would often put a kind of oil on those feet to kind of help mask and cover up. Are you tracking with this at all? If you want to enjoy your meal, this is an essential oil. You like that? Yeah, that's good. John tells us that's exactly what happened. His feet have been washed. She breaks this thing open and drenches his feet and then mops up the excess with her hair. Some of you are uncomfortable with that detail because it's too intimate. In fact, some of you are thinking, that almost feels sexual. Wrong. Intimate, yes. Let me give you one more cultural take on this. There were some that have noted that when a guest's hands were needing to be dried for whatever reason, there were servant girls, and you would dry your hands in their hair. Now, I'm not, you know, I mean, there's a whole lot that needed to heal in that society, in that culture, and this would have been one of those things. I'm just telling you, this woman is assuming the role of a servant. You want to know what it looks like? It looks like this. It is an outlandish, outrageous, bold act of serving. But there's something else going on. Because this is an era where you don't have a lot of indoor plumbing. You don't have water. Nobody's taking showers every day. You're not washing your hair. You're not doing any of these things. So you're not just freshening up your feet. What you would often do for a guest is give them oil to freshen up. And what you would do if you couldn't bathe or anything else, you would put that oil on your head, on your hair, and just kind of, and it also helped to mask what was going on. Are you still with me? So what you wouldn't do was take like the really expensive stuff and give it to a run-of-the-mill guest. You probably wouldn't put that stuff on their feet either. You'd just put it on their head, on their hair. John says that she goes all in. It's like a pound worth of this stuff. Incredibly expensive. She breaks the container. There's no going back now. And she douses him, his feet and his head. He's dripping with this. John says the smell filled the whole house. Like, you think that smell lingered for days in the house? You think that smell lingered for days on Jesus? Remember that. It starts a conversation, and people are like, oh. In fact, look at this. I love this. It says, some of those present were saying indignantly to one another. Now, by the way, in the Greek, that means to snort. You ever seen somebody who indignantly, bah, 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 bah. I can't believe we're spending that much money on that. Bah, that's too expensive. We could be spending that. That's what's going on here. And what they're saying is we could have spent that money on the poor instead of this. This is ridiculous. Now listen to me, that's a great question to ask. We ask that question all the time. How do you spend your money? Essentially, that's what Advent Conspiracy is all about. You figure out the wise way to spend your money. But John, again, helps us and tells us what the real motive is, because sometimes our motives aren't lofty. First of all, he tells us who starts this blah. It was Judas, as in Iscariot, as in the betrayer. And then he gives us one more little tidbit. This was the treasurer. He was our treasurer. Oh, yeah, and he embezzled from our fund. He's the one who held the bag, and he's the one who liked to tap into it. So he's the one who says, hey, we could have liquidated all of that, and I could have had access to that money. Judas' motive was pure greed. Jesus knows this. He listens to all of this. He sees them. We cannot overstate this. They're ganging up on an easy target. This is a woman, and they are picking on her in that culture. And Jesus says, knock it off. Knock it off. She is doing something beautiful for me. There's a verse in there where he says, you will have the poor with you always. Now, people struggle with that. I think Jesus' record on the poor, pretty clear. We're to serve them. In fact, he takes it so personally. When you do this to the least of these, I'm there. I'm present. You're doing this to me. Jesus is very clear about that. But right here, right now in the story, he says, we are at a unique place in the timeline, and you guys are missing it. She did this for my burial. What? He's been telling them that he's going to die. Now, Mary doesn't understand this fully. She just hears the whispers on the street. She sees the look on Jesus' face. She sees storm clouds brewing on the horizon. She just knows he's in danger, just like everybody else. What if he shows up? I wonder how much longer will he be with us? I just want him to know how much he matters to me. And so she does what she could. I mean, she goes all in. One of these details that you see is that this was worth a year's salary. So you got to think about this now. She didn't have any earning potential, but they're kind of breaking this out. This would have been like a family heirloom. You take just a few drops out. No, she's taking the whole thing. Would you do me a favor right now? Those of you who are working for a living and have an annual income that the IRS knows about, what Wow. What's your annual income pre-tax? Come up with the number right now. Come on, you got it. You got it? Come on, don't act like, well, I don't know. It doesn't matter to me. No, you know what it is. Go ahead. What, you got that number? All right, now turn to your neighbor. And, no, don't do that. That'd be funny. No, your number. It's different than the person around you. Your number. That was the gift. That was the gift. I mean, she did that in one outrageous act. You want to see what it looks like? That's what it looks like. It's sacrificial. It's not just outlandish and courageous and out, you know, for everyone. It's sacrificial. Now, here's what you can turn and talk to your neighbors about. What's the most extravagant gift you've ever given? Not received, but given. Go ahead, talk to each other. It'll be different for each of us. It's been different each service. You guys know how to reach us on the app. What's the most extravagant gift you've ever given? Go ahead. Okay, all right. Let me just tell you some of the ones that I'm getting, and I really, you know, obviously I don't expect any of you to say these out loud. That would be sort of embarrassing and all of that. So from Grant's Trail, somebody said a trip. So we've gotten that in several cases. It's like I gave a trip to my parents. I gave a trip to my spouse. It was a honeymoon celebration. It was that kind of a thing. Another one that has really just been like over the top is jewelry. Gave jewelry. Okay, so there's that. I love this. From Mid Rivers, I gave my time to cook for my sick neighbors. Okay, that's pretty extravagant. It's really all over the place. Rolex? Oh, yeah. From Fenton, a monkey? I don't know. There's a story there. I'd love to know it. Lots of these, I'm going to guess, from parents. College education. I gave my kids their college education. Yeah. Okay. Feeling that. Love. Somebody online said a car. Ooh. Somebody said an airplane. Whoa. Somebody said time as a sponsor in AA. Bone marrow transplant. A kidney. Okay, we probably should stop there, don't you think? This one's for free. Did you notice what you were doing when I was reading those off? You were doing the same thing that they were doing in the story. Some of you were snorting. I can't believe somebody came by. You shouldn't be doing that. You don't know the story. You don't know. Now, let's go this route. Why do people give so extravagantly? Well, okay, there's a lot of reasons. Can we just say that? Sometimes we give extravagantly so people can notice that we gave extravagantly. Sometimes we give extravagantly to make up for something. Oh boy, I hope you forget what I did. Sometimes we give extravagantly to get something in return. Sometimes we give extravagantly just because we love. I just can't help it. I don't even know. It's kind of beyond reason. I'm just doing this because I love you. Sometimes it's to celebrate a relationship. Sometimes it's to bless. You see how that works? This needs to be said. Mary wasn't being extravagant to get something from Jesus. She already had her miracle. Think about it. She had already seen her dead, decaying, stinking brother walking out of the tomb when Jesus just said the word. She had her miracle. She was known for sitting at his feet and hanging on his every word as a disciple of his. Mary's not doing this to get something from Jesus. Mary's doing this to bless Jesus, to love Jesus, to serve Jesus, to celebrate Jesus, to say, this is for you. Why this matters is because when we live our lives this way, it moves the heart of God. What did Jesus say? She's doing this for my burial. Watch how these details crash together. Another time you would anoint someone is in preparation for burial. The one time you wouldn't anoint someone for preparation for burial is if what? If they died as a criminal, say, oh, I don't know, on a cross. Those people are not anointed. You toss them in an open grave. They've been crucified as criminals. I want you to see how these details come together. When a guy by the name of Joseph of Arimathea asks permission of Pilate, he's one of the religious leaders. You talk about an act of love and courage. He goes to the Roman consul and says, can I have the body of Jesus? Where are the disciples? They're nowhere to be found. He's the one that says, can I have the body of Jesus? I don't know that I'm going too far out on a limb here. When he's taking the body of Jesus off of the cross, he's talked to a couple of his buddies or people who work for him to help him. And you're taking that now dead weight, literally. And you're smelling everything that is around that death. The sweat, and the spit, blood. You think it's too much to say that when he's carrying Jesus and he can't help but just smell the blood matted in his hair, do you think at any point he or one of the people caught a whiff of something else and said, wait, was he anointed? I think that smell lingered. Jesus is saying, this is the only anointing I get for my burial. Now let me say this. Some of you give in outrageous ways. It is time. It is walking over to a sick neighbor's house. Sometimes it is an outrageous financial gift. It's all of these things. It's forgiving. It's championing. And in every way, when you give sacrificially, it moves the heart of God. He sees it. He gets it. He takes it all in. Even if nobody else does, he saw it. It matters what it matters to the person. It matters to what he's doing in this world. And it matters to him. Jesus says her gift is a legacy that's going to echo out in ways you can't even imagine. Some of you needed to hear that today because what you are doing matters and it moves the heart of God. Even if nobody else saw it, he sees it and he glories in your generosity. Jesus says all of this and then tells them one more, cut it out. Leave her alone. Judas, still stinging from this rebuke, now goes to the religious leaders, the chief priests, the ones who want him dead. And he bargains for Jesus' life. It's not all in this account, but 30 pieces of silver, we don't even know what those were, but if you compared 30 shekels, let's say, to a year's salary, it's not even close. Judas doesn't think that much of Jesus anymore. I don't like him. I don't like him as a leader. He's failing me. He's not getting me what I want. I'm gonna go talk to these enemies, and that's it. The deed is done. The deal has been sealed. Judas sold his soul. You need to know this was someone who knew him. This was someone who knew better. David Garland at Truett Seminary, this quote, he said, people did not come pouring out of the saloons and peep shows to kill Jesus. It was the religious politicos and one of Jesus' intimates who did him in. And this is where it gets hard to hear. Judas wasn't the only one who failed Jesus that day. I think we forget something, and I need to now remind us of that. So please just stick with me on this. Do you ever forget things? How many of you forgot something this past week? Just raise your hand. Yeah, let me help you. Those that didn't raise your hand, you forgot that you forgot. So we're all in. We're all in. I don't care how old you are. We're all in. We all forget. I love this story. You'll be nice to this, okay? This is a preacher joke, so you be nice to it, all right? That wasn't encouraging at all here. Are the sights with me? And don't give me a little bless his heart afterwards either. Because I know what that means. That doesn't mean bless my heart. That means bless his heart, Lord, he's an idiot. So don't you give me one of those bless his hearts. There's an older couple, elderly couple. They're sitting at home and they're watching, I think it was a Matlock marathon is what they were watching. And he gets up and says, I'm leaving. Do you need anything? She goes, you know, as a matter of fact, I would love a hot fudge sundae. Strawberry ice cream, double fudge, whipped cream, no nuts, cherries. I want the whole thing. He goes, okay, I got it. She goes, you didn't write any of that down. I got it. Yeah, I know your memory. I got it. Mine like a steel trap. You're going to forget. He leaves. He's gone for an hour. He comes back. Now she's watching NCIS. But now he drops this paper bag in her lap and keeps walking past her. She watches him, looks at him, opens the bag. It's a ham sandwich. She looks at the sandwich. She looks at him. She looks at the sandwich and said, I knew it. You forgot the mustard. You get it? Bless his heart. Listen to me. Sometimes you have forgotten what you've forgotten. When we talk about grace, we sing about it, we celebrate it, it's how we live. I mean, it's like, and some of you are like, Greg, I got that part. It's the letting go of religion. It's the letting go of earning my way into God's favor. It's coming to him and receiving this gift that we keep talking about. And that is everything, it really is. But some of you have received that gift. Some of you, your eternity is settled with God. And then you think, well, I need more than grace now. Give me the deep stuff. You have forgotten how big a deal grace is. It's not just how we get close to God. It's how we live life with God. The writers of scripture say this is an inexhaustible wealth. This is, you get to the edge of what you can imagine, and God's grace and God's love is deeper still. You need to ask God to continually stir your heart in wonder when it comes to his grace. That's how you're going to live. That's how you serve. That's how you love. That's how you cheer for rivals. That's how you champion. That's how you forgive. That's how you live an absolutely upside down life that becomes the new normal. Jesus last week said something that we didn't have time to go into. Listen to these difficult words. Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it. But whoever loses their life for me and for the gospel will save it. Nobody wants to talk about that. Listen, crucifixions were ugly, disgusting, scary things. And everybody in the Roman Empire knew what they were because Rome wanted you to see them up close. They happened on the side of the road so everybody could see them. Everyone within earshot knew what a crucifixion looked like, sounded like, and they knew a crucifixion meant death. What is Jesus saying here? If you follow me, there's going to be some dying involved. Now, in the coming days, there would literally be people, history tells us, who were crucified on crosses because they followed Jesus. You know this is a part of our heritage. Today there's persecution, but this is a part of our heritage. There's a guy by the name of Balthazar Hubmaier. His name will not be on the test. Great Anabaptist theologian in the 1500s. Anabaptist, what does that mean? He was one of the people in the Reformation who said, no, we need to baptize people after they have confessed their faith in Jesus. So it was a big deal. He was a writer. He was a debater. He was an intellect, towering intellect. I mean, you probably never heard of him, but this guy was a thing back then. Lived on the border of Germany and Switzerland. Difficult, volatile times. In two separate occasions, he recanted his beliefs. Now, I'm gonna tell you this. He did it while he was being tortured. I mean, literally on the rack. So he recanted. And then later he repented and said, and he even wrote a short apology that just said, please forgive me for my human weakness. I'm glad that God has humbled me. A third time this happens and he doesn't recant his faith. In fact, what happens is he's now being sentenced to die. He's at a place where he's going to be, and I want to make sure I get the date right. March 10th, 1528, he was burned at the stake. As he faced the fire, he prayed for grace in his great suffering. As the flames engulfed his beard and his hair, his last words were these, oh, my heavenly Father, oh, my gracious God, oh, Jesus. The witnesses said that it looked more like he was experiencing joy than pain. Gang, that's heavy. Why would I tell you that? You and I aren't going to be burned at the stake. You and I are not going to be physically crucified. But we can learn from these people who have gone before us. And what did he do? He kept his eyes on Jesus. What is Jesus saying? For future generations, there's going to be some dying. There's going to be some letting go. There's going to be some painful moments. But here it is. You keep your eyes on him. This is not about self-hate. This is not about self-destruction. Please don't misquote me or Jesus. That's not what he's saying here. If you need help in understanding how to live this life now, and you're feeling some of that disgust, and you're feeling that, okay, no, it'd be better for me to just go to heaven. Don't you believe that? That's a lie from hell. We'll get you up next to a Christian council. We'll surround you with people who will remind you that God's not finished. But come on, if we're gonna do this, the only way, if we let go, the only way is to keep our eyes on him. And that sounds too simple for some of you. Listen, we love talking about the Greek tenses of a verb and the Hebrew traditions and the Roman history and how culture and art, we love talking about that, but I'm gonna net it out for you. If he's not the king, he's not worth following. But if he's the king, he's worth everything. You know that song? In the morning when I rise. In the morning when I rise. In the morning when I rise. Give me Jesus. Give me Jesus. Give me Jesus. You can have this old world, but give me Jesus. He's worth it. Jesus says, what would it profit you if you gained the whole world and lost your soul? I'm worth it. That's what he keeps saying. I'm worth it. Money? Come on. We're going to talk about money in a few weeks, how Jesus feels about money in the Gospel of Mark when we go back. And some of you are like, ooh, Greg, when? I love when the Bible talks about money. let's just say, I don't know. Keep showing up and I'll tell you. But here's the thing. Here's the thing. When you give outrageously, like open-handedly, watch how you treat your stuff differently. Now it doesn't have a stranglehold on you. You want influence? Then give up the lust for power. You want to be happy? Learn how to serve others. You see how this is shaped? For people who are fearful, you're going to have to give up the need for security in everything. For those of you who are prideful, you're going to have to learn how to cheer for your competitors. For those of you who are cynical, you're going to have to put to death that snarky reaction that you have to everything. For those of us who are lazy, we're going to have to destroy the idol of comfort. You see how this works? There also, for those of us who are just so bitter, we're going to have to let go of the grudge. If we're going to follow Jesus, there's going to be some dying along the way where we have to do this, but it will never happen on your own. It'll be by God's grace, and you keep your eye on him. If he's the king, then he's worth it. This is the cross-shaped life. This is how it works. But in closing, I need to tell you, they did not live this out. The disciples, if you're really going to make me tell you, they were probably more failures than followers in these moments. They were probably more like Judas than they were like Mary. It's the upper room now, and Jesus is preparing them for something, and he's looking forward to this important meal. But even as it's happening, he tells them something we already know. There's a betrayer in our midst. We're having a meal with somebody who's going to turn on me. He's going to fail me in the most horrible of ways. And what did they say? Is it me? Isn't it interesting? Jesus didn't specifically single out Judas and go, there's a betrayer among us, and right there, it's him. He doesn't do that. He just says there's one among us who is doing this. And all of the disciples are like, well, wait, is it me? It couldn't be me, could it? I think Jesus wants them to examine their hearts. They need to examine their hearts. And then with one final look from Jesus that probably broke the heart of heaven, but didn't break the hardened Judas. The betrayer leaves the table. Everybody is now trying to scurry and make sense of all of this. He leads them through something we'll go over next week, an acted out parable, this way to remember and to experience him. I hope you're hungry for communion next week, those of you who believe. But after the meal, they go to the Garden of Gethsemane. It's where Jesus is going to suffer alone. But before then, he says something to them. Hey, you know, when Judas left and everybody thought they were off the hook, you're all gonna fail me. He says, every one of you is going to fail me. Quotes a prophet. He says, so when God strikes the shepherd, the sheep are going to scatter. When it starts to go down here in a little bit, you guys are going to scatter like roaches when the light gets flipped on. When it starts to cost you, you're going to sell me out. If this could happen to the 12, do you think it could happen to us? Do you think there are moments that we could compromise? Do you think there are places where we could say, wait, if it's costing me too much, God, I'm out. One writer said, that means there's a little bit of Judas in each of us. I don't even like the sound of that. Is that too blunt? It was for Peter. Peter hears this and does what Peter does. He corrects Jesus again. Essentially, he's calling Jesus a liar here. He's like, it's not going to happen. I love this, though. He says, Lord, Others may be doing this, but not me, right? And the disciples are all going, Peter, we're right here. But he's like, I'm the exception to the rule. I know those guys, but I'm the exception to the rule. Jesus says, no, you're going to deny me three times before daybreak. You're going to hear the rooster a couple of times, and it's already going to have happened. Peter still doesn't shut up. He doubles down and says, no, even if I have to die, I'll never disown you. And then everybody else jumps in and says, yeah, what he said, Jesus, us too. It's just empty words. In Gethsemane, they're already failing him. He says, can you just stay awake and pray for me? They can't even do that three times. They can't even do that. Finally, in verse 41, he says, what's the use? There's a mob coming up the hill. It's got, you know, lanterns and torches and clubs and swords. And leading the way is Judas, who plants the kiss of death on Jesus' cheek. There's this scuffle that Jesus has to settle. But then in verse 50, it happens. They all scattered. Every one of them, they scattered. Even the guy that we talked about in the first week of this series. Remember that little detail that only Mark has? That somehow there was a young man that gets grabbed by the authorities, and in the wrestling, they're left with his garment and he's left with his birthday suit running through the woods naked. You remember that? Remember how some of us said, well, if this is in fact the house of John Mark, then it could be, some scholars think, that it's Mark, who's a young guy following along at a distance, watching all of this. And he gets caught up in this thing and he's leaving. If that's the case, one commentator said, then this is Mark's remorseful signature in the story. It's Mark's way of saying, you don't know me and I'm not a big deal, but I was there and I failed him too. They take him to the chief priest's house. Peter follows along at a distance. I'll give him that much credit. He's warming himself around a fire. Somebody thinks they recognize him. Hey, aren't you with us? No, not me. He goes over to the entryway to try to get away from the crowd. Servant girl follows him. Hey, no, I know it's you. You're with him. No, it's not. Third time later, somebody comes and says, no, it's him. It's him. And with this, Peter calls down curses, it says. We don't even know what that sounded like. Was he saying something like, I swear by God that I'm telling the truth? Maybe. My guess is it was worse. Did he curse Jesus there? All we know is that it was bad enough for people to leave him alone. Wow, if you talk like that, I guess you don't follow him. Luke gives us this detail. Someplace in the proceedings, Jesus is brought back outside so they can beat him up some more and abuse him, and the swearing and the hitting, and it all now is just raining down on him. Luke says at the very moment that this is happening, Peter profanely denies Jesus for the third time. There's a rooster echoing in the distance, and it says the two of them in that courtyard made eye contact. Jesus saw Peter do this, and they made eye contact, and with that, Peter wept. It's not just that I know I did it. Now he knows that I did it. Now, I used to think when I read that when Jesus looked at him in that moment, Jesus was looking at him with such disappointment. And I told you not. I warned you. Now, this is just me. I used to project that look onto Jesus' face with me, where Jesus is looking at me sometimes going, oh, I'm just so disappointed. Then I read this Scottish theologian by the name of Sinclair Ferguson, who said, that look was the turning point. Because when he looked into the eyes of Jesus, he didn't see condemnation, he saw compassion. When Peter made eye contact with Jesus, he didn't see someone who said, oh, you are such a disappointment to me. What he saw was someone who says, I see everything about you and I love you. This is the beginning of a different life for Peter. He repented. Judas regretted. He turned to Jesus. Judas turned in on himself. You see, this is what you do when you fail. You figure out, am I going to follow Jesus? And is he enough even then? It took a lifetime, but Jesus shapes his life and he begins to just get things done. To the point where this bumbling, proud fisherman, by the time he's outside of Rome facing his own cross, he doesn't deny Jesus. He doesn't curse. Tradition tells us that he requests to be nailed on that cross upside down because he didn't think himself worthy of dying in the same manner as his Savior and friend. Jesus met him in the struggle and the doubt and the failure, but Peter followed. Friends, I have no idea what you're facing. For some of you, it's like an epic decision that's going to change your life. It's going to define things for the next few years. He's worth it. Keep your eye on him. Trust him. Ask him. For some of you, it's such a private decision right now. Nobody even knows but you. He's worth it. Take the next step. For some of you, you have a pile of failures behind you, and you think it's over. It's over. You remember that Jesus looks at you not with disappointment, but with love and says, I'm not finished with you. Come on, take the next step. He's worth it. He's enough. Take it from a failure, learning how to follow. Give me Jesus.